to Hope for the Caregiver here on American Family Radio. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is the program for you as a family caregiver. More than 65 million Americans right now are caring for a chronically impaired loved one. For the benefit of those new members to this audience, every week we're getting new members here. For the benefit of them, I want to explain to you that wherever there is a chronic impairment, there is a caregiver. So if you have someone in your life that has some type of chronic impairment, whether it be disease, whether it be trauma, whether it be addiction, if there is a chronic impairment, there's always a caregiver. If you are that individual right now who is caring for someone with that chronic impairment, you're in the right place, and I'm glad to have you here. I'm bringing nearly 40 years of experience as a caregiver to offer a lifeline to my fellow caregivers, to point them to safety, to help us stay strong and healthy while taking care of someone who is not. I was having a conversation this week about all the events happening in the Middle East right now, and this individual is with the State Department. And I asked about Iran, which is, you know, a topic that's on a lot of people's mind. What are we going to do about Iran? Were they involved? And you hear the party line, which is there is no direct evidence that they've done anything. You hear that they have not used that $6 billion, not one dime of that has been used towards this. Well, you've also heard the word fungible. You know, we talk about that word a lot in our media. And we all know that if you have the promise of $6 billion coming towards designated funds for, you know, humanitarian needs, then you can automatically assume that you don't have to tie up your own funds for that. If somebody says, hey, I'm going to give you $1,000 to pay for your gas, well, you can free up that $1,000 you're going to pay for gas to pay for something else. We all know that, okay? It's pretty obvious. So they're tap dancing around this issue. And I asked a simple question. Can you trust Iran? I'm asking you as this audience, do you feel like you would do business with Iran? I mean, that's like, you know, when somebody said, is mail-in voting safe? They said, oh, yes, it's safe. I said, would you mail $1,000 in cash to someone? Well, no. Well, then what's the difference? Sometimes asking the better question helps identify the root issue. And when I asked the question about what is the plan to deal with Iran moving forward, the answer I got back was it's complicated. Now, there's two things that I will always challenge the person on when they give me these answers. You don't know the history, or it's complicated. Both of those answers to me send a different signal maybe than they think, or maybe that's exactly what they want to do. But it says, number one, if you don't know the history, then you're not read in, you're not important enough, you're not, you know, engaged enough and studied enough to be able to speak intelligently on this. Or if they say it's complex, then that's another way of saying you're not smart enough to understand this. Well, see, I don't think it's complex at all. I think we have created complexity in order to not deal with the root issue. And the root issue is, can Iran be trusted? Now, what does this have to do with being a caregiver? In my nearly 40 years of this, I have talked to a lot of caregivers, and I have seen a consistent theme. We get embroiled in the complexities that we use to obfuscate the root issue. The root issue is not complex. The root issue is challenging, but it's not complex. For example, if you are in a relationship right now with an alcoholic or an addict, what is consistent about addicts? What is the one consistent behavior you'll find about addicts? They lie. That's what they do. Addiction and lying go hand in hand. Again, just ask anybody in any recovery plan of any kind of recovery professional, anything. Ask any recovering alcoholic or recovering addict. That's what they'll tell you. They lie. So what's our responsibility when you're in a relationship with somebody who's like that? If you go into them saying, well, maybe they won't lie this time. No, you go back to what Reagan said, trust but verify. Okay, so you don't go into business with an alcoholic. You don't give them, if they say, well, look, I need $300. If I could just get through this weekend, give me $300 and I'll pay you back. And they are actively drinking or using drugs or not even actively doing it. You going to do it? You going to give them the $300 without any strings attached, without any verification, without any accountability? You going to do it? No? Well, why not? Because you know they lie. It's not complex. You have to deal with boundaries. You have to deal with accountability. You have to verify. That's the way you deal with it. It's not that complex. It's challenging. But challenging and complex are two different things. I would suggest to you that it's extremely challenging to deal with what's going on in the Middle East. But when you boil it down to its core elements, how complex is it? Yes, if you want to have all kinds of nuances in any kind of treaty and this, that gets very complex. But the root issue is it's always going to be very simple and it's always going to be connected to the human condition. You see, there are two competing thoughts. Number one is human beings are getting better, more noble, our character is improving, and we're evolving towards better people. And the only thing standing in the way of that is education. We need to educate ourselves more. We need to throw more money at it in various forms. But we are evolving towards better human beings. That is one competing idea in our culture. The other comes from a biblical worldview, which says we're not evolving as better people. We may sin differently than we used to. In fact, Billy Graham said many years ago, there are no new sins. We just invent better ways to do them. But it's still the same sin because the heart is still the same heart. What does Scripture say about the human heart? Jeremiah 17:9 states, the heart is deceitful above all things and desperately sick. Who can understand it? Now that's what Scripture says. Okay? And that's not the only passage in Scripture that refers to the human heart. When you say the words total depravity, you hear that a lot in Calvinism, for example. Now, before you flinch when I say Calvinist, some of you may, just hear me out. The word total depravity, you've heard that, is part of TULIP, T-U-L-I-P, which are the 5 points of Calvinism. TULIP is an acrostic that stands for T, total depravity, U, unconditional election, L, limited atonement, I, irresistible grace, P, perseverance of the saints. I'm not here to debate Calvinism with anyone. I just want to tell you what total depravity on that means. We say total depravity, but what we confuse that somehow with utter depravity. We can always sin more. Utter depravity is different than total depravity. Total depravity means the whole system is contaminated. That there is not one part of us that is not contaminated by sin. Now, this is a biblical worldview that sin contaminated us. We accept that there are certain contaminants in water and we'll drink it because they're acceptable levels, if you will. What's an acceptable level of sin to be contaminated with? Well, according to God, none. You know, and once we realize that that is the human condition, that we are contaminated by sin. Now, that's the biblical worldview that is in direct competition with the worldview of saying humans are getting better. We are not ridding ourselves of sin because part of the human view is minimizing or even trying to eradicate the stigma of sin, saying that it's not sin, but it is. And so we get ourselves in these messes that we call complex, but at the root of it, there's sin. There's sin in there somewhere. And once we understand how to identify that, then everything else will flow from that understanding. So when somebody says something is complex, well, maybe it's gotten that way, but at its core, like dealing with Iran, would you trust them? Like dealing with an addict, do you have accountability and boundaries? When you're a caregiver, that's an important thing to know. With her permission, I will tell you this on a personal level. Gracie's healthcare needs are complex, but her core needs are not. She requires assurance, which is the theme of Scripture from Genesis to Revelation, that God sees us, He redeemed us, and He will see us home. We will not evolve ourselves into better. We have been regenerated. This is Peter Rosenberger, and that is Hope for the Caregiver. We'll be right back.
In a world where no one can tell us no, To this day, every human being born on this planet is the product of a male and a female. That's the way God set it up.
God created us in His image.
A place where Facebook and YouTube have no control.
I think the command in Scripture relative to men and women is not mainly women sit down, but men stand up, act like men, lead as you're supposed to.
A place where we can no longer be canceled.
When the Scripture speaks, God speaks. And if you understand that rightly, then everything else simply falls into place.
The American Family Association presents the AFA streaming platform. Just visit streaming.afa.net for the latest films, documentaries, and AFA original productions. You'll even find videos from some of your favorite talk shows. All you have to do is create a free account at streaming.afa.net. In a world where no one can tell us no.
To this day, every human being born on this planet is the product of a male and a female. That's the way God set it up.
God created us in His image.
A place where Facebook and YouTube have no control.
I think the command in Scripture relative to men and women is not mainly women sit down, but men stand up, act like men, lead as you're supposed to.
A place where we can no longer be canceled.
When the Scripture speaks, God speaks. And if you understand that rightly, then everything else simply falls into place.
The American Family Association presents the AFA streaming platform. Just visit streaming.afa.net for the latest films, documentaries, and AFA original productions. You'll even find videos from some of your favorite talk shows. All you have to do is create a free account at streaming.afa.net.
Oh, I love that voice. That is my wife, Gracie, and I love her singing that song. I wrote that song many, many years ago, and I love hearing her sing it. Thank you for your indulgence on that. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is Hope for the Caregiver. HopeForTheCaregiver.com. Healthy caregivers make better caregivers. I am joined today by a very special guest. I've been actually wanting to have him on for quite some time, and he has been gracious to work with our crazy schedule this fall. And this is Edward Grennan. He is the editor-in-chief of Guidepost Magazine. I've had the opportunity to write for Guidepost in various forms, most recently in their Strength and Grace magazine that they have. And he's got a new book out called A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. And it is a deeply moving book, and I'm excited to have him talk about this. So, Edward, welcome to the program. Glad to have you here.
Thank you, Peter. I'm very happy to be here. And you mentioned crazy schedules, and you know something? I don't know anyone who doesn't have a crazy schedule, particularly in the fall. But so it's a pleasure that we're able to work these things out, and we can finally get to talk. I've been anxious to speak with you, especially about the subject of caregiving, which is it is so prevalent in our country. I mean, we are, in a way, a nation of caregivers. In one form or another, we're giving care, and if we're not giving it, we're receiving care. And sometimes it's both. So caregiving is a burden of love. And even though the circumstances that may call for caregiving are difficult, so often brings us together. It makes us aware of the power of empathy and giving of ourselves. It's not easy. As you know, caregiving can be tremendously stressful and difficult.
That's why I look the way I look, Edward.
I think you look pretty good.
Don't let this happen to somebody you love. For many years, of course, Guidepost is a staple in our country and around the world. And for many years, we received it. Gracie's grandmother was a huge subscriber for many years, and I read it. And then I started noticing a change over the years, most recent years with you guys, and I started noticing more conversations about the caregiver world. And I was intrigued by that. And I actually, like I said, I wrote a few things with you guys, but I didn't know your story. And now I know why, as the editor-in-chief. And you, how long have you been there?
Well, I showed up in 1986, if you can believe that. I was jobless, penniless, almost homeless, and struggling to find recovery from drugs and alcohol. I don't know why Guidepost hired me. I wouldn't have hired me with my background. And I didn't know what Guidepost was. When I got the call, I thought it was a travel magazine. So I thought, oh, maybe I'll get some trips out of this job. So I went in for the interview, and I liked the people, and I read the magazine, and it was really intriguing. And I said, I'll stay for a year. And that was in 1986. And I have been there ever since. I became editor-in-chief in 1999 and have been so ever since. If you change the title from a travel magazine to change that word travel to journey, it has been my spiritual journey to be involved in this magazine and in this audience that supports the magazine, who tells the people who tell their stories of faith and action in everyday living, lifted me up. And it's really, it put me on the road of recovery and to spiritual growth. And it's a journey that I wake up every morning and thank God for.
I think it's marvelous what you've done. And I've been tracking the changes, and now I recognize that that's been your handprint on this, and ultimately God's handprint on moving so many of the stories into the caregiving world to recognize that we got over 65 million caregivers in this country. Also, you started at Guidepost the same year I became a caregiver in 1986. I was also struck by quite a few things in your journey. I mean, this was a part of your life before your mother's Alzheimer's. You had a brother with Down syndrome. And so these are not new things to you.
No, you know, and with my brother, Bobby, who had Down syndrome and who was just a few years older than me, I was the youngest. And you know, that so much revolves around that child and necessarily importantly. So I remember, I'll tell you this one little story about my parents, who were just the most devout Catholics. And they you know, were church going, you know, believing Catholics, and they really trusted the church. And after Bobby was born, and they knew that he had Down syndrome right away, and they told my parents, and my parents brought Bobby home, and some priests came to the house, and they sat my parents down, and they said, you know, we have orders of nuns whose ministry is to care for these children, and if you like, we will take Bobby, and we will raise him and care for him and give him all the love he needs. And it was the closest I ever saw my mother slap a priest. Because she said, you know, she said, nobody is going to take care of this child but us, and we will do it better than anybody else could ever possibly do it with God's help and God's love. And that's what they did.
Well, from what I could tell about your mother's personality that you so beautifully recounted in this book, I can imagine she darn near came off her seat and lunged at the priest. You know, she was not a timid woman.
No, but it's the only time I ever saw her like argue with a clergy member, because that was not in her character. She was a strong-willed woman. She was very bright. She was raised by a school teacher. Her mother was a school teacher and learned how to read before she even went to school. She was way ahead of her class and skipped grades. You know, eventually she was in the 1950s, as a young married woman, she was a quiz show champion on television. She was really sharp and really fast. So when that time came years later, when she began to develop symptoms of what would be diagnosed as dementia, and eventually she did die of Alzheimer's, it was, you know, we were in denial, you know, and it wasn't that we just were in denial that this strong, bright, vibrant woman was suddenly slipping in a way that not only we didn't understand, but we couldn't stop. And that took us a while to get past that denial, because we kept trying to say, oh, it's just the normal vagaries of an aging brain. So she forgets to turn the stove off, or she forgets to, you know, what she wanted to pick up at the store and has to go back three times. We tried to rationalize all that, but it got to the point when you know, the needs for her caregiving needs became too obvious to us, that we had to do something, and we had to start doing things for her that she always had done for herself. And she didn't like it either.
In the book, you recounted the story at church where she couldn't do some of the library functions, the deposits and things such as that. And that must have been incredibly heartbreaking for her.
It was. When I heard, I was living in New York, and this is, we can get to this later, but I had to do a lot of caregiving from a distance and felt very, very guilty about that because I was in New York working. And my brother and sister-in-law and sister were really the ones on scene to take care of mom and really saw her daily. You're right. That first hint was, one of the things my mother always did to help out at church every day was to count the collection basket after morning mass. And then she would fill out a deposit slip and take it to the bank. She'd done it for years. And it made her feel very much a part of worship and a way to help the pastor. And Sister Carolyn, who was my mother's confidant at the time, called us one day and said, look, your mother is not counting the collection basket correctly and goes to the bank and everything's wrong. So we don't want her to feel as if we don't trust her and depend on her. But from now on, I'm going to count the basket with her, and then I'll fill out the deposit slip and I'll go to the bank with her so that everything runs smoothly. And she said, you know, but we don't want her to think that we're not counting on her, because she so needs to feel needed and to feel like she's contributing, that we don't ever want to take this away from her, but we're going to have to supervise it just in case you hear anything. So, and that was heartbreaking. And it was not long after that Sister Carolyn also told us that my mother's job as the church librarian was also being undermined by her increasing forgetfulness and confusion. And she wasn't shelving. The Dewey Decimal System kind of defeated her. She couldn't shelf the books the way.
Well, she's not alone in that, by the way.
No, I couldn't find the book today in a library if I had to without Google. But she had to kind of, that had to be taken over, but in such a way that we weren't making her feel that she was inadequate. And all that time, it had run, and Alzheimer's runs in my family on my mother's side, and both of her sisters had died in memory care, along with her father, and one of her three brothers also suffered symptoms. So she must have seen this coming and wondered what would happen to her. It must have been terrifying on some level, but she was such a strong and a woman who would never complain about what she was going through, let alone admit it to anyone else, that it really, we had to like have the courage to step in. And that was hard, to give her care we knew she needed, and yet it was difficult for her to accept. So the dance that went on, where we were just trying to help out rather than we're keeping an eye on you because we're afraid you're going to hurt yourself or get into some trouble, it was just, when those roles reversed, when you as a child become the caregiver to the parent who has always cared for you for decades and decades of your life, it's a very difficult transition, and I had great trouble with it at first.
Well, you recounted this well in the book, and I also I was really quite moved at the beginning when you opened it up, and you were questioning your own forgetfulness. Is this what's laying ahead for me? Is this what's waiting around the corner for me? Because it runs in your family, and it's a couple things that you've forgotten, and you the self-doubt and the fear was gripping you. And I love how over the period of this book, you were able to bring the reader and make peace with that, shake hands with that, the fact that, okay, whatever's around the corner, it's around the corner, but I'm going to live today. And I thought that was a beautiful thing. We'll talk more about that when we come back from the break. We're talking with Edward Grinnett. He is the editor-in-chief of Guidepost Magazine. His new book is called A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. And there's much more to come when we return. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is Hope for the Caregiver, hopeforthecaregiver.com.
Heaven changes everything. That was our theme for our fall share-a-thon here at American Family Radio. Hello, everyone. I'm Tim Wildman. I'm the president of AFA and American Family Radio. Just wanted to say thank you for giving during share-a-thon. Our loyal listeners always come through, and we can't make it without you. Your prayers and your financial support just so vitally important to what we do here. So just wanted to say thank you. Have a great day. Keep listening to AFR.
Weekday mornings at 8 Central, Pastor Jeff Shreve offers real truth for today.
I'm the pastor of First Baptist Church in Texarkana, Texas, and the founder of From His Heart Ministries.
The world around us is rapidly changing, but God and His truth will never change.
I may be the host of the show, but I want God's Word and His truth to be the star of the show.
Join Pastor Jeff Shreve each weekday morning at 8 Central for Real Truth for Today on American Family Radio.
Today we conclude this week's focus on truth. In Joshua 24:15, Joshua challenged the people by saying, "If you've got a problem serving Jehovah God, then be honest enough to state who you will serve." Hello, I'm Sam Rohr with the American Pastors Network and another Stand in the Gap Minute. Serving God requires purposeful choices with a life that proves it. Well, most Americans say they're Christians, their lives don't prove it, and our culture unfortunately reflects it. Saltless salt, little light, no morally prevailing influence. It's our lives, not our words, that matter. The time has come to reject idle speech and hearts that worship other gods. Holy living and a compelling Christian testimony and embracing truth with no other gods before us is a choice. May we, like Joshua, declare, "But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." Will you join with us at Stand in the Gap Radio and TV and choose to serve the Lord of Truth? Sign up and stand with us at AmericanPastorsNetwork.net.
Welcome back to Hope for the Caregiver. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is the program for you as a family caregiver. HopeForTheCaregiver.com. I am continuing my conversation with Edward Grennan, the author of the new book, A Journey of Faith, as he recounts caring for his mother through Alzheimer's. But it wasn't just Alzheimer's. This has been a part of his life for his entire life, the journey of a caregiver, plus his own wrestling with demons of addiction and alcoholism, and what led him to be the editor-in-chief now of one of the most beloved magazines in the world. And Edward, I wanted to address something. One of the things I've done on this program is connect the dots for people in relationships with alcoholics and addicts and identify them as caregivers, because addiction is a chronic disease. It's a chronic impairment. And if wherever there's a chronic impairment, there's a caregiver. And so those same principles apply. And as you walk through recovery, you've been in recovery for a very long time now. As you've walked through your own recovery through this, did you see the same principles of recovery applying to you as you journey with this through your mother through Alzheimer's?
I did. And a part of the book covers the fact that I had been sober for some time when my mother began exhibiting symptoms of dementia. And as I said, I was a long-distance caregiver, so that sense of control almost, you know, was difficult because I was 650 miles away in New York and she was in Michigan. I had what they call in 12-step programs a slip during that period. And I slipped badly. I went back to drinking. And it turned my life upside down. It certainly didn't do me much good as a caregiver. And, you know, what I had to realize, and I didn't at the time. At the time, I said, well, I'm an alcoholic, and it's a chronic disease, and you have it whether you're sober or not sober. You still are an alcoholic. And you turn your life over to God in order to get through your sobriety a day at a time. And I refused to think about that my mother's condition and her need for care had affected me in a deep emotional way that triggered this new round of drinking. And I did see a counselor in a detox unit, and he kind of forced me to realize that, you know, I said, I don't need an excuse to drink. My brother's not drinking. My sister's not drinking. And they're dealing with my mother's condition. So why, I don't have that excuse. But he took me through it. He said, yes, you do, because these changes in your life all of a sudden are triggers. This fact that your mother needs care and she's not going to be there to care for you are triggers for emotional responses that you know, in some people can trigger an addiction, and other people can trigger anxiety. And I finally came to grips with the fact that this situation with my mother and the need for caregiving to be there for her were what triggered this episode of addiction again. And I, you know, thank God I did go back to the meetings that I had got me sober in the first place. And I've been sober ever since. And that's been about 27 years. So I'm terribly grateful for that. But for me, I look back on it and see, you know, my mother's sudden need for this huge amount of care really turned my life upside down in a way that I wasn't even willing to admit and realize at the time. And I think a lot of caregivers go through, and they may not be alcoholics or addicts, but they go through a period of real stress and anxiety and fear more than anything when a loved one is suffering like that. And
well, we're going to medicate with something.
Right.
That's just the human condition. And whether it's this illusion of control or whatever it is that we got to do, sex, drugs, alcohol, we're going to medicate with something. It's very painful, and we're going to do this until we bend the knee and say, you know what, I can't do this.
I surrender.
You know, I surrender.
The important thing I did find out was, you know, and I'm sure you've talked about this on your show, self-care for the caregiver, taking care of yourself. You know, I did realize that there were things I needed to do for myself, give myself permission to do as a caregiver or as a family member of someone who needs such care. You know, it was okay to take a vacation, for instance. I wasn't turning my back on my mother if I got to, you know, go on a nice trip somewhere. You know, there were times when I needed to disconnect when I could, not to abandon my mother in any way, but, you know, I had my brother and sister and sister-in-law to help out too. And there were ways that we eventually were able to make sure that we could all get a break, you know, and we pick up for each other when someone was on a break and a vacation or a retreat. But so you learn to take care. You know, what I learned, interestingly enough, in this caregiving situation with my mother, I learned how to take care of myself better than I ever had. After I got through that addiction slip, I really learned how to take care of myself, because I knew that I had to be there for my mother. And the only way I could do that was to keep myself healthy. My late wife used to call it the oxygen masks syndrome, that, you know, on an airplane, when they read you the safety regulations, they tell you, you know, make sure to put your oxygen mask on first before you try to help anyone else.
I call that really the Delta doctrine. I heard that on Delta years ago.
Really true.
Called it the Delta doctrine.
Yes, it's absolutely true in life. You have to take care of yourself before you can take care of somebody else. And you have to love yourself in a way that you can then give that love to another person and reap the rewards of it. Even in the end, I was so grateful to be there for my mom. And I started this journey not knowing for sure whether I could do that. And of course, I didn't do it on my own. I did it with the strength of a higher power and friends and families. There's a Franciscan church right down the street from my apartment in Manhattan. And I used to walk my dogs by that, for those Franciscans. And they'd often be out in the front steps, and they'd always come out and bless my dogs, which was, for me, you know, just incredible that they would come and say a prayer over my Labrador Retriever or my Cocker Spaniel. But I began to talk to them too, just a few minutes every day. And they'd just say, how are you? You know, and I'd tell them, and they said, well, you're doing everything you can. And that's all you can do. And God will give you the strength to carry on. And hearing that every day was wonderful. And it helped. Everything helps.
Well, and we've got to hear that every day. That is the whole premise of everything I do here, is just that healthy caregivers make better caregivers. And
yes,
I want to switch gears into the book for a moment. One of the stories in the book that you connected me to, it was about Patty and her father. And I teared up with this. And because I have a lot of callers to this program that I've dealt with, and people that I've talked to who are in this situation where they had an abusive father growing up, and then the father declines significantly, and then they're put in that role of caregiver, and yet they have serious unresolved issues. And yet here they are. And so talk a little bit about Patty in that story. It was a beautiful story.
It is a beautiful story, and I've told it a lot. Patty was I wasn't in a situation like Patty's, but I understood that so many people are. I have friends are. And Patty was a woman who grew up with a very stern and angry father, whose, you know, capacity to express love and to give love was severely limited. He was a Marine officer. You know, she said she knew how to sing the Marine hymn before she knew how to sing Happy Birthday. And, you know, and you better sing it out loud, and you better do it the way he wanted you to do it, or else you'd hear from it. So she was raised by a drill sergeant, and she ran away from that house as soon as she turned 18. And as soon as she left her mother, divorced this angry, stern man. And it could have stayed like that for decades, and it did. And Patty went out and she married a man the opposite of her father, who was kind and loving and supportive, and she had children. But she gets a call one day out of the blue from a man who runs his trailer park in Southern California, sort of out in the desert, and says, you know, are you Patty? And I won't give the last name, but and she said, yes. Well, she said, your father's here, and I think you better come see him. And she just froze. She had cut him off and cut her feelings off from that man decades before. And, you know, she finally goes out to the trailer park. Her father is well into dementia at that point, and he can't take care of himself. He's living in a rat trap of a trailer with just chaos. You know, the trailer manager had found Patty's name somewhere in his things, going through trying to figure out who to call. And Patty eventually has to bring him home. He's diagnosed at the VA hospital as having Alzheimer's, and they send him home, and she asks God, she says, how can I love someone who didn't love me? And now you're asking me to love this man. And the journey she goes on from that point, as she tries to get close to him, and the Alzheimer's began to pull away at all his defenses. And she learned about his childhood that he never talked about, learned how tough he had had it, learned how frightened he was, and how he had put on this armor all his life to protect himself from his own feelings and from other people's feelings. He was scared of feelings. And in the end, finally, he says that one thing that he had never said to her. One of the last things he said to her, he said, Patty, I love you. You're my daughter, and I love you. And the walls that were broken down by that moment were just staggering. And in my life, the last words that my mother spoke to me, the last word was love. And she hadn't spoken at all for a long time. And I was telling her what, I was at her bedside, and I knew it was the very end, and there was not much more we could do for her. And the real caregiving had been taken over by the people at the memory care unit where she was. And I was sort of confessing to her, which I felt bad about, but I was saying how I was sorry for all the years that I was not necessarily a good son, and that I knew she had loved me for all those years, no matter what. And that last word she said to me was just the word love. Wow. And my mother died shortly after that. So, and you know, what I discover in my journey in the book is that there are two things that even a disease like Alzheimer's, and I would say other diseases as well, two things that can't destroy. And they're really two, they're one of the same thing, and that's love and that's faith. They exist outside of us in a way that a disease like Alzheimer's cannot destroy. And what was left with my mother was her faith and her love.
Mm. Beautiful story, Edward. We're talking with Edward Grinnan. His new book is called A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. This is Peter Rosenberger. This is Hope for the Caregiver. Don't go away. We've got more to go. We'll be right back. I'll never forget walking into the hospital room after Gracie had her second amputation. Both legs are gone now. And she looked at me. She said, I know what I'm going to do. And I was kind of startled. I said, well, what are you going to do? She said, I'm going to help provide prosthetic limbs to my fellow amputees and tell them about Jesus. And I said, well, baby, can we get out of the hospital first? But she never let it go. And for almost 20 years, we've been working out of Ghana, West Africa. We treat patients all over there from other countries that come there. We send supplies. We send teams. We sponsor patients. We work with a prison where inmates volunteer to disassemble used prosthetic limbs so we can recycle the parts. All of this because Gracie trusted God with her heartache. We've got a huge shipment of supplies that is being loaded up right now to go out soon. Would you help us do it? StandingWithHope.com/giving. StandingWithHope.com/giving. There's prosthetic feet, knees, pylons, sleeves, adapters, all kinds of connectors. All of these things we are sending over there so that people can walk. We're going to point them to Christ. Help us out. StandingWithHope.com/giving.
When kids are little, they respond well to clearly defined commands. When they grow up, however, they begin to resist taking orders from mom and dad. Hi, I'm Mark Gregston with Parenting Today's Teens. If you have a teen in your house, you already know what I'm talking about. Kids don't like to be told what they should have done or what they need to do better. When teens are wrestling with new issues in life, they seldom respond to a lecture. Many times, repetition at this stage of development only reminds them of how they failed or missed an opportunity to shine. Constant nagging, correction, and badgering often just pushes them away. So back off a little. Most of the time, what's really needed is a listening ear.
Mark Gregson is devoted to helping parents of struggling teens. For more helpful parenting resources, go to ParentingTodaysTeens.org, ParentingTodaysTeens.org, or search for Parenting Today's Teens in your favorite app store.
You don't have to worry, and don't you be afraid. Joy comes in the morning. Troubles, they don't last always. For there's a friend named Jesus who will wipe your tears.
Welcome back to Hope for the Caregiver. This is Peter Rosenberger. That is Gracie again. We're glad to have you with us. We're continuing our conversation with Edward Grinnan. He's the author of the new book, A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers. I was reading this book and there was a scene, Edward, that was so poignant, and I immediately just found myself reliving a scene similar to that. I used to work at a place many, many years ago when I first got married, and there was a customer that would come in, and here I was a caregiver. I was in my 20s, and this guy came in and he was in his late 60s, and he drove a blue Cadillac. I can still see it today. And he would get the wheelchair out for his wife and he would take her everywhere. She had Alzheimer's. And this is back in the 80s. And I watched him caring for her, and she had mobility impairments as well. And I immediately thought, is that my life? Is that where I'm going with this? And here I was in my 20s and here I am now in my 60s. And yeah, that is my life. And it's not a bad life. It's just a challenging life. And when I read your book, I was looking at the scene at Howard Johnson's when you were working there as a young man and you saw that couple. And I want you to talk about that because that it hit me and it took me immediately back seeing that couple for me, what it did for me. But it did something for you when you saw that couple. And I'd like for you to talk about that a minute.
You know, I was a teenager and I got a job being a busboy at our little corner, Hojo's. And I knew a lot of the people there, and my mother and the ladies from church would always have breakfast there. So, you know, it was sort of almost like family. But there was one group of senior citizens who used to come in on a regular basis. And there was a man, and he was always very well dressed. And he would bring his wife in, and she was always impeccably made up and impeccably her hair. Everything was perfect. She was beautiful. I mean, maybe way overdressed for Howard Johnson's. And I would watch him, and I was a teenager.
I need to say something to my audience here. For those of you who don't know, Howard Johnson's is an upscale Waffle House. That's an, for those of you don't remember Howard Johnson, that's an upscale Waffle House.
So it, you know, so it was a great, it was a great community place. So he'd bring his wife in every day, and I observed them as a naive, self-centered 15-year-old. I noticed how much he did for her. Yeah, and she must have had some impairment in her eyesight, because he would always say, "Okay, you know, the butter is at 6 o'clock, and your tea is at 4 o'clock," and you know, and I noticed that she would argue with him occasionally, not bitterly in any way, but she, he would suggest, you know, "Would you like your oatmeal?" And she said, "I don't like oatmeal." And he'd say, "Well, you've had oatmeal like every day of your life since I've known you." And I suddenly realized, you know, not only was she somehow impaired and he was trying to make her life as normal and as livable as possible, but that when I looked at her with her makeup and her perfect hair and her beautiful clothes and how well put together she was, I realized that he did all that. I thought, how did she, if she's so confused and she doesn't know where things are and she forgets everything, and it's because he was taking care of her. And that left me with such, I hadn't known anything like that before. And I thought, he gets up at dawn every morning and gets her ready to go out and have a nice breakfast at Howard Johnson's. And he doesn't have to do that. He could, but he, it's meaningful to him to give meaning to her life, even as that meaning was slipping away from her. What I thought about years later, when my mother had dementia and I knew that the end was coming, you know, I suddenly remembered that man in Howard Johnson's. And I thought, what happened to him after she died, after she went on? And that's a great dilemma for caregivers, really. When you've, you know, devoted so much of yourself to the care of another human being that you love, and you've poured all that love and carried that burden of love to you, through your loved one's illness or whatever, you know, or whatever injuries, there's a terrible void left when, you know, and it's not one, I mean, maybe you feel relief from the daily grind of it, but there's something about what you've been giving and giving and giving, and now there's no place to put that giving. And I've talked to caregivers in putting together the book who really struggled with that, who had to get past it, because it's not only the grief that they deal with, but it's the loss of purpose, because your purpose has become, you know, lifting up and caring for this other person. So it, you know, I give some tips in the book about, you know, what you should do, and that's if you are in that situation, and certainly reaching out to other people, because caregivers will often lose, you know, they put everything on hold sometimes, you know, their friendships, their social activities, a lot of the things that filled their life before caregiving did, they have to get back, and they have to be intentional about it, or they will get sort of trapped in this strange void, this emotional and spiritual void that can afflict a caregiver whose caregiving has come to the end.
One of the things I've tried to do on this program is to help caregivers push back on what I call the three I's. We lose our independence, we become isolated, and we lose our identity. And we stop speaking in first person singular often. And so I always ask caregivers that call into my program, how are you feeling? And that's where the stammering, and that's when the tears come, because they're not used to speaking from their own voice. And that's part of it, is how do we regain ourselves? How do we not get lost in someone else's story and have those moments? And it's been a lifetime battle for me.
And as I said, we are becoming a nation of caregivers. So this is something that's only going to grow. The brain diseases like dementia and Parkinson's, as the population gets older, those conditions are more and more prevalent, which means the caregiving must be more and more prevalent. And yes, there's a division between what you can do for your loved one at home and ultimately what might have to be done for them in a care unit. But still, the amount of caregiving that the country is called upon to provide for the people who need it is becoming larger and larger. And we don't want it to overwhelm us. On the other hand, the act of caring for someone you love and helping them when they can't always help themselves, you grow as a person, I think. No matter how painful and anxious caregiving can be, I think it helps you grow as a person. In my life, I've never grown much when I was happy and content. You know, I found spiritual growth and emotional growth in the difficult times, in the challenging times when I was challenging myself or God was challenging me to be more of a person than I thought I could be. And caregiving, I think, brings a lot of that out in us. But it does teach us empathy and love in ways that we could not have been taught those things without it. Or at least in my case. And I
share that with you, Edward. I really do. And I'm a better pianist. I'm a better writer. I have more clarity of thought because of this journey, because it's forced me to deal with hard realities. I wrote a piece that's in one of your publications, Strength and Grace. I don't know when it'll be out. And I've tried to do some more of that, but I've been busy with some other writing and caregiving. And so hopefully I could do some more. But there's one that I think that's going to touch you. I think this is the piece that's going to be in the next issue. And that is, I was playing the piano. There's a woman in our church who, and I do the music down our little church here in the valley. And this man and his wife, and he's caring for his wife. She has dementia. And it's fairly pronounced at this point, but she's been a violinist for a very long time, a wonderful fiddle player that she's traveled all over, and she's just very, very, very talented. And she'll just kind of look off into space. But I told her to bring the violin to church, and I said, don't worry, I'll handle the heavy lifting on the music part. Just let her play. And she was playing one Sunday, and this is the story I put in Strength and Grace. She was playing The Old Rugged Cross. And she's looking off into space while she's playing it from memory. And her playing was beautiful. It was just flawless. I stopped playing and let her just play it a cappella. And the whole church was just, you could tell they were all holding their breath listening to it. It just reverberated around the church. It was one of the most beautiful performances of the hymn I've ever heard. And they all knew that she was struggling with dementia. She didn't, you know, and yet her music was still there. And I just saw the tears in her husband's eyes, just filling his eyes. He had such pride and was able to hear his wife play. And I thought about just the power of music, what it does, how it does so much in those moments, but also how important it was for that church to experience that. That we're not going to shuffle this off like the priest tried to do with your brother. No, we're gonna embrace where they are. And that's so important. In our last moment, close us up in the last 30 seconds, close us up with your heart on this.
I heard what you said about music, and I have stories about that because music sometimes remains. My mother could sing hymns long after she lost the ability to speak. But what I think caregiving taught me more than anything, and I want people to hear this, and it might be helpful, is that it taught me to be present in the moment. You know, when you're caregiving, you have to be there with that person, and particularly with Alzheimer's, because they're often only in the moment. And when my mother would go off and say she had conversation with people I knew who were dead, instead of trying to fight that, I would always say, yeah, well, what did you talk about? Why did you want to talk to that person? How did that help you? And I just went with it. And sometimes that's the best we can do, is just go with it. Let us be led where we're going to be led, and not try to fight it and not try to control everything except those things that we can control.
That is a great way to end this conversation. Edward, I'm going to have you back on. This was just so powerful and meaningful, and I appreciate very much you taking the time. Edward Grinnan, the author of the new book, A Journey of Faith, A Mother's Alzheimer's, A Son's Love, and His Search for Answers, available wherever books are sold, and certainly out at Guidepost.
ShopGuidepost.org.
ShopGuidepost.org. ShopGuidepost.org. Please, this book will have you in tears, and you will love this book. It will touch your heart in a very profound way. It did mine. And so I thank you, Edward, for being a part of this. This is Peter Rosenberger. Well, this is Hope for the Caregiver. We'll see you next time.
The views and opinions expressed in this broadcast may not necessarily reflect those of the American Family Association or American Family Radio.
Faith. Family.